Today's episode of Ferment About It has been brought to you by the Brooklyn Slate Company, a manufacturer of slate cheese boards, coasters, and other fine items. For more information, visit brooklynslate.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Planet Earth, how you doing? Welcome to Ferment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
And I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And we're your hosts for this show on all things fermentable. We especially concentrate on beer.
We are live every Monday night at 7 p.m. And we are also on iTunes and archived, again, on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Today's episode features me, and Mary, and we're very excited about that. But we have some guests coming up that are in future episodes that are going to be really awesome. Our friends who couldn't make it today, Peter Salmon, Eric, and Oscar Norlander, some of our favorite local home brewers, unfortunately couldn't make it, but they will have them soon.
Yep. But we're excited. So we're going to talk today about inspiration and some of our favorite tools in home brewing. Because I think, you know, sometimes you just get stuck in a home brewing rut, or you get to the point where you just don't have enough time, or you're brewing, you know, you have a disruption in your brewing regimen, and you move, or, you know, something happens.
Which is actually what Peter and Oscar and Eric are dealing with. They're moving, so they couldn't be here because they're moving their entire brew house.
Yep.
From one place to another.
Yeah, that's it. Moving is one of the most disruptive things, I think, besides having maybe your equipment destroyed somehow. So there's times when you just get stuck in this rut, or you don't feel like you have time, you're not inspired to homebrew. So we're going to talk about kind of getting out of that homebrewing rut, and also just...
Or even starting homebrewing, if you haven't gotten to certain areas in homebrewing.
Absolutely. Or even if you're not necessarily stuck, but you kind of keep going with the same style over and over, how to break out of that and try something new.
I did something new this weekend, Mary. We just brewed our first beer together at 508. We're starting a collaboration. If you don't know, I'm the head brewer at 508 Gastro Brewery at 508 Granite Street between Canal and Spring. Come by frequently and often. And we're starting a series called Pillow Talk. And so basically, me and Mary are making a series of sour and smoked beers.
Which are my two favorite styles, if you haven't heard that from me before.
And a lot of people are very scared to brew sour beers on a professional level or even at the home level because of, you know, the bugs that are you deal with. The bugs I refer to are like Lactobacillus, Brettanomyces,
Pediococcus, Acetobacter. So yeah, a lot of people are scared because they don't want to get the rest of their brew house infected. So I think that's one fear. The other thing is that working with these bugs, I mean, Brettanomyces is actually a wild yeast, whereas Acetobacter and Lactobacillus and Pediococcus are all bacteria. But when you work with these, they're unpredictable. It's not like pitching, you know, a vial or a packet of American ale yeast. You kind of know what's going to happen there. You know what conditions it thrives in. And that's not necessarily true with some of these wild yeast and bacteria. So I think those are the two things that keep people from brewing sour beers or funky beers. But there are ways around that.
It's never kept you. I've seen your basement. You have a lot of funky stuff going on down there.
Yes, I have a science background, so I don't know. I'm just not very scared of the funk. I think, you know, I mean, when we, as homebrewers, when we clean and sanitize our equipment, you're basically getting rid of all of that other yeast. And Brettanomyces is just a wild yeast. There's no reason why you can't, keep your brew house clean.
Yeah, but what you were talking about, Brettanomyces and Pediococcus and Lactobacillus is like 1/10 of the size of the normal yeast strain. So there's a lot more places and more variables and places where they can hide. And so I heard on a podcast recently also that you know, it's not so much of a big deal on a homebrew level, but right. I should be scared at we're dealing with a lot more different parts and valves and a lot more of little crevices where these things can hide out. And you don't usually want to do that, or you want to be very careful if
That's
you
true.
Are doing that.
Yeah.
And so our method in doing our first beer, which was Berliner Weiss.
Yeah. So our first is called Bangin' Berliner. And we were first inspired actually when we had Jesse Ferguson call in last, I believe it was in November. It was one of our early episodes. And he talked about he does a Berliner style beer called Monkey Chase the Weasel.
Yep.
And it's delicious. They actually make, he doesn't call it a Berliner Weiss. He calls it a Berliner Weiss style, I think. And he also adds mulberries to it. And it's just a delicious, refreshing beer.
Delicious.
And he doesn't do it. So both Chris and I, he uses this technique called kettle souring. And when he called into the show, he talked all about how he did the process. And it was super interesting and seemed very approachable, not only on a homebrew level, but also to be able to brew this at 508. 508 has a two-barrel system. So it's kind of a big homebrew system.
Yeah, it's absolutely a big homebrew. And what it is actually, let's talk about that real quick. It's a HERM system. It's a heat exchange recirculation mash system. And I have a temperature control that I have heat elements in both the hot liquor tank and the boil kettle, but there's no heat element in the mash tun. So, and I have a temperature control on the hot liquor tank, but I don't have temperature control on the mash and on the boil kettle. In the boil kettle, we just have on and off switches, but on the hot liquor tank, I can set it to a certain temperature. So in order to do this sour kettling or this kettle sour, we had to keep it at a certain temperature. And so I unplugged the boil kettle and replugged it into where the hot liquor tank was plugged into and set
which
it
which is
at,
a regulator.
Yeah.
Like a temperature.
Yeah, temperature control.
I'm not so good on those technical terms.
Yeah, terms.
And that
it's a really cool thing that keeps the temperature. You just type it in and there it is. It's magical.
Yeah. So the other thing is, though, so what we started with, I'm just going to backtrack a little bit. Yeah. We started with Jesse's show. You know, we really re-listened to the show. We had been talking about how to make a Berliner Weiss. I mean, a Berliner Weiss is one of my favorite styles of beer. Chris and I had both made Berliner Weisses in the past, but using more traditional, or what I used to consider traditional methods. Whereas I did mine, a standard brew. I think I pitched a 5-to-1 ratio of lactobacillus to saccharomyces, I believe. I used the recipe from Stan Hieronymus's book, Brewing with Wheat, which is actually a Kristen England recipe. It's an excellent recipe. And I got very good results using that. But again,
do the lacto first and then pitch a yeast?
No,
that's
a
common
think,
question for
I know,
people
I know, and I don't have my brewing notebook in front of me. I believe I pitched them at the same time. I just pitched in the ratio where I had much more lacto than Saccharomyces.
And did you do it open air or did you do
nope,
it airlock?
I used closed, right. I used an airlock.
Okay.
Which is different. So Chris, tell everybody how you did your Berliner.
Yeah, I actually pitched lacto first, and then I, instead of putting an airlock on, I put a cheesecloth on and I had it in my closet, and I had I let all the funk of my closet get in there, and it actually ended up pretty good, but a little bit too much uncontrollable stuff in there in the end. I thought it was good, but once it warmed up to a certain temperature, too much Florida Brooklyn.
That closet was packed full of a lot of crazy stuff back then too, let me tell you. So those are two different techniques. And I've had a lot of friends, I've tasted a lot of homebrewed Berliner Weisses that were made by friends or people that I've met, and you really get varied results. I think when you pitch lactobacillus, you know, depending on the conditions, your temperature, the ratio of Saccharomyces to lactobacillus, your wort, what sugars are in your wort, that all determines how sour it is. And of course, time. That all determines kind of how sour it is. Also, you know, I got this crazy pellicle going on, and it was interesting.
Scare me.
Pellicles are beautiful.
That's scary.
But yeah, so we... Anyway, this whole kettle souring, I think, once Jesse called in, really opened our eyes, and it's definitely seems to be somewhat more of a predictable way to get souring. You have more control, I think, in how much sour. It's faster.
Can be. I mean, it depends on how you do it. If we were to pitch lacto and do a kettle sour, then I feel like that would be relatively more predictable than how we did it. How did we do it?
Absolutely. So what we did is we did the same technique as Jesse. Once we did, you know, we did a standard mash. We mashed low. I think, what do we end up mashing at? Like 149?
Yeah, 149.
So around 149, we used half wheat, German wheat, and half pills.
Got it about 1036 gravity going into the kettle.
Yep. So we, you know, racked it over to the kettle or ran it, pumped it over to the kettle. My brewing system now looks terribly primitive compared to brewing on 508's brewing system. I love all the heat controls and the pumps.
Pumps are great.
We don't have a pump in our home brewery yet.
You look good in pumps, though.
But anyway, once we pumped it over to the kettle, we stabilized
the temperature first. We got it down to about 108, and using this PID, this control just kept it right there, and then we took 1 pound of unmalted.
Well, actually, and to get it down that far, so we actually topped it off with a little water because we were slightly higher gravity than we wanted.
Filtered cold water.
Yep, and then because we didn't have hours to wait, it was Friday night and it was getting a little late, so we actually ran it through a wort chiller to chill part of the wort.
Using said pump, we pumped it out of the kettle as if we were doing a whirlpool. Except this time with the chiller and back in.
Yeah, so that was our shortcut. Just, you know, that's something that could be done, certainly if you're doing this. Anyway, so we stabilized it. We got around 108 degrees. We had a probe. We have a probe taped to the side of the brew kettle. Mm-hmm. And we figured out that there was a differential of about 10 degrees between what the probe was and then the temperature probe that goes inside the brew kettle that you just read, but the probe on that we taped on the outside is the one that is actually hooked up to the heat regulator.
Exactly. So basically got the temperature stabilized. Yep. And then we took 1 pound of grain of Pilsner malt and unmalted and just sprinkled it in.
Yep. Toss it in there.
Put some tin foil and saran wrap over the top, but we put a CO2 blanket on because oxygen is not good.
Yeah, you wanna discourage other organisms from taking over your wort at this point. So we wanted to encourage lactobacillus production only. And growth only, pretty much. And lactobacillus is naturally on the outside of grain, so that's why we tossed some Pils malt raw, you know, it's not raw, it's malted, obviously, but we didn't grind it or anything, we just stuck it in there. That naturally has lactobacillus cultures on the outside. But you want to discourage other things like enteric bacteria, which I'm totally forgetting the name of right now, and other acetobacter, that kind of thing. So you put that's why we have it at 108 lactobacillus. I was searching the internet, of course, before we actually decided to the exact technique, and lactobacillus, I came across an article which we'll put a link to on our website about kind of ideal growth conditions of lactobacillus, and they really like to be, you don't want to get above 130, pretty much. We didn't want to really get above 120, because a certain percentage will die out above 120. I think ideally they really like to be at like 98.6 degrees body temperature, but they also will thrive in higher temperatures as well, whereas other bacteria and yeast will not thrive at those temperatures. Right. So we decided, you know, we wanted it between 105 and 115, and ultimately 108. And then the CO2 takes out the oxygen, and lactobacillus does not need oxygen to grow. So we wanted to, again, eliminate any of those other bacteria that might feed on oxygen. So CO2 blanket, he doesn't have like the kettle top is wood and it's not tight. It's not a tight seal. So we put aluminum foil down first and then a bunch of saran wrap, and that totally worked.
It was fine. And if you're doing this at home, which is easy and fun, and you don't, I mean, maybe you're not able to keep it at a certain temperature, or you could.
As regular as
what I'm able to do at 508, but you can put it in your oven. If your oven goes down, you could probably test, or maybe if you have if your oven is open a little bit and keep your oven on it at the warm temperature, check what temperature your oven is and then do this for the, and basically, then you just taste it throughout days. I mean, for us, we left it for 40 hours and then went to a boil.
Yep. And yes,
it was sour, delicious. And lovely. Yeah.
Now it's a little weird tasting a sour beer because of course it is unfermented, and there was a lot of DMS when we first took a taste because of course, I mean, this thing was cooking, basically. I mean, it's at 108 degrees. It's producing a lot of DMS, dimethyl sulfide, and there was nowhere for it. It's not, we're not boiling it off or anything. So that was a little off-putting at first, but we had to put that aside when we tasted. It's nicely sour. It does have still a lot of sugar because, of course, it's not fermented yet. So that was kind of interesting. But once we cooled down the sample, I mean, I think it's going to be a great beer. And it was a super fun experience. And if this works out, we have lots more plans. We're going to do a Kentucky Common.
It definitely worked out. And I think that this, you know, you can do this for any beer you want. If you like sour, this is a great way mm-hmm. to do it. And it also keeps your brew house safe. Why? Yep. Because at the end of all this, after those 40 hours that we waited and got it sour, we then boiled it and killed all that lactobacillus. So we got the flavor, but we killed off the lacto by pasteurizing or boiling for
right.
a very short
time. And we decided to boil because we didn't, if you do a decoction mash, then you can get your hops, you can do your get your hop bitterness in that way. That's how I did my original Berliner Weiss at home, is I did a decoction mash and no boil. So that's how I got my hops in. You really, in order to, you would only need to bring it to like 180 degrees to kill off the lacto.
Right.
But because we wanted some hop utilization, we went ahead and boiled just for 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, we had to add more hops as a result of that in order to get the IBUs that we wanted, which wasn't many. I think we were around five to eight IBUs
with a low alpha hop. We used a low alpha German Hallertau version called Herzbrucker, which mm-hmm. is a really cool, really neat hop.
Yep. And then we pitched Nottingham yeast last night, and it's fermenting.
It's fermenting. The things to be careful are also pH here.
Yeah, that's the one thing. We didn't have a pH meter. We ordered one. I think it's being delivered tomorrow.
It actually is in my bag right now. It got delivered today.
So that is something that we'll do different in future Pillow Talk sour collaborations, is use the pH meter, because it's helpful to take pH readings along the way. I think that's a good way to
find how sour you are, and also
exactly.
making sure that you're not going to kill off your yeast or yep. let your yeast thrive.
And also, then you can replicate the experiment, so you'll know what pH, you know, if we knew what pH we were at, if we wanted to replicate this Berliner, it'd be a lot easier if we had the pH, besides just relying on our taste buds.
Right, we wouldn't have to taste it all. We would just get it down to that pH and let it ride.
Yep.
Anyway, we're going to take a quick short break. Thanks for listening to Ferment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Brooklyn Slate Company is a collaborative effort from Brooklyn graphic designer Sean Tice and Parsons graduate student Christy Hedeka. After visiting Christy's family slate quarry in upstate New York in the spring of 2009, the two grabbed a few pieces for use as all-purpose boards back home in Brooklyn. They found a number of purposes for the slate and began gifting pieces to friends. The response was so overwhelmingly positive that the two struck out to produce a line of slate products. They now make regular trips to the family quarry in upstate New York to hand-pick their favorite pieces of black and red slate. Some of the slate is sourced from the quarry graveyard, a collection of odd-shaped pieces that were ultimately destined to be ground for use as road cover or baseball diamonds. They then transport the pieces to their studio in Red Hook, Brooklyn, where they do additional cutting and clean the stone to be food slate. Every single piece of packaging that comes with their products, from the envelope to the burlap bag, can be repurposed for other uses. The end result is a product completely unique in cut, shape, color, and overall presentation. For more information and to order, visit brooklynslate.com.
Oh, we got to talk about homebrewing.
Yeah, Mary wants to talk about homebrewing stuff. Hey, welcome back to Ferment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm Chris Kuzmi. This is Mary Izette. And in the studio, we have Jaren David taking pictures and having fun. You can see these pictures. He's an awesome, awesome graphic designer and photographer and a dear, 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 dear friend.
Yep.
And if you haven't met him, goddammit, get yourself to New York and meet Jaren David. That should be on everybody's list.
And he takes the majority of the photos that are on our Facebook page as well as our website. We finally updated our website last week, so we will have tonight's episode, all the links and all the good stuff that we talk about, probably tomorrow. I can't guarantee tonight. But please check out our website. We'd love to get feedback and hopefully you find some good resources.
In our first segment, we talked about brewing sour beers at home and in the kettle, no matter where that kettle is. And we didn't expect to spend so much time talking about it, but it's because we were inspired and very excited about doing it. One of the things we want to talk about today was, you know, inspiration for home brewing and, you know, rejuvenating that. And
yep. So I want to say, well, first of all, before we go from the sour, so these are kind of like what my takeaways. A, we needed a pH meter. We ordered it Friday night. It's now in Chris's bag. So we're definitely going to get that. I also I've never used a refractometer before.
Yeah.
I think maybe in ChemLab or something, but never at home. So Chris has a refractometer at 508. I love it.
A refractometer, Mary?
So it's a good way to measure gravity. You can't measure final gravity, but you can measure gravity along the way, and you can just use a drop.
Yeah, it measures the density of your liquid,
right?
It automatically accounts for the temperature of your liquid. So you can take a hydrometer reading or a gravity reading, you know, straight from your boil kettle, yeah, any temperature in your mash tun or whatever's happening, you can do that. But once there's alcohol involved, it kind of offsets and messes with its structure. There is a graph and a program to account for that. I actually don't know where it exactly is. I know there's one on Moorbeer.
It's great because a lot of times, you know, I want to take a gravity reading when I'm boiling at home to see, you know, how maybe I'm boiling a little faster than I think. Especially, you know, I just started I brewed for the first time a week and a half ago on Chris's stove, or, you know, what's my stove now, and I've never brewed on that. And, you know, I think I boiled a little faster. Still your stove.
My kitchen.
I was boiling a little faster. It would have been great if I had a refractometer, because I could have taken gravity readings along the way and known kind of where I was at. Also, you know, it's a new stove. I wasn't sure my efficiency was going to be the same. So I think it's a helpful tool. They're actually pretty inexpensive. I think I got mine for under $25
that's
really Amazon.
Good. Yeah.
And it's shipped today.
I like the refractometer because if you have a target gravity that you're going for, that you can stop your sparge going into your kettle if you've already reached your gravity, and then top off with water
it just takes a couple of drops. You don't have to take all the ounces that it takes to fill your hydrometer tube, which is a huge benefit, I think, as well.
Absolutely. And you don't have to wait for it to cool, so you can do it in real time. Because if you were taking from your boil kettle and then putting it in your hydrometer tube,
you have to wait for it to cool down,
then you're losing time while it's going on, and you wouldn't, you know, it's brew time. You gotta be brewing.
The other thing is that I do a lot of other lacto cultures, lacto fermented beverages, like sodas and ginger bugs and flies and stuff like that. And I think that you could actually do kettle souring. I know that some people will kettle sour by adding a packet of lactobacillus. Now, one reason why we use the grain is lactobacillus is actually pretty darn expensive. I think it's like $11 to $13 at our local home brewing stores for one packet. And why invest in that if you don't need to? But that would be a cleaner way than using grain, especially if you're not, if you can't keep your temperature consistent to get the kettle souring at home. The other thing is, another takeaway is that I want to experience with is using some yogurt cultures, either from straining the whey from yogurt. And or I picked up some yogurt cultures at Brooklyn Kitchen over the weekend, and
Brooklyn
I'm going to play with those as
Aren't
well.
Aren't you a teacher at Brooklyn Kitchen?
Yes. So yeah, I'm joining the teaching staff at Brooklyn Kitchen. We hinted at this last time, but I'm teaching the April 11th Intro to Homebrewing class. You can sign up now. Actually, it's on their website. It's at 6 p.m. They usually run from about 6 to 8:30. The price is $145, and that actually includes a kit. So it's a good deal. I mean, you go home with all the information and the kit to make your first beer. I mean, you could actually start brewing that night.
It's an awesome store, too, and they're great people.
Amazing,
and they are
store.
Also sponsored of Heritage Radio Network.
Right. Yep.
We love them.
So I'm going to be – that's going to be my first time. I'm probably going to be co-teaching or teaching, and then I'll – be teaching in the future, and I'm very excited. I mean, the other thing is their facilities are amazing. They have an amazing kitchen. It's really an incredible store. So
yeah. Do you have any more take homes from the beer that we did?
No that's it.
But
let's talk about some of the tools.
I was about to say that. Yeah. So we use different tools for the homestead and there, and what I'm talking, when we say tools, we're talking about actually brewing software,
right? And that was something interesting. So I actually sat in on a Dan Pizzillo is another instructor at Brooklyn Kitchen, and I sat in on in his beginning homebrewing class a week or so ago. And it's really interesting because a lot of stuff, even though, you know, Chris and I go to the New York City Homebrewers Guild, we go to the Brooklyn Bruisers meetings, we have tons of friends at homebrew, there's certain things like you never talk about, and brewing software is one of them. Yeah. And Dan uses a different brew software than Ray, who's another instructor at Brooklyn Kitchen, and a completely different software than I use. So I think that's something, I don't know, I use BrewPal. So I used to use a Mac-based homebrewing software, and once I heard about BrewPal and downloaded it, you can use it on your iPhone, probably your iPad too, but it's $1.99. on the iTunes store, and it is a freaking brilliant little app.
That is a bargain for me. I think I will buy some.
But anyway, so I would highly recommend BrewPal. It's, like I said, it's only $2. I've probably been using it for a couple of years now. I don't know how long it's been out. At least a year and a half, 2 years. And really, it's a lot of features have been added in recent updates. It has color swatches. It has a flavor and aroma wheel, hop substitution list. It has the BJCP style guidelines built in.
So you use it when you do. Very customizable. So you've always used it, or at least you have for the past 2-3 years?
Right.
Recipe formulation?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
And the cool thing is, so it's in my... I mean, obviously, I have my phone with me pretty much all the time.
Yeah, kind of all the time.
And a lot of times, you know, maybe I decide on the spur of a moment I'm going to brew either, you know, the next day. So say it's a Friday and I decide, ooh, I'm going to brew Saturday. I have a couple hours, you know, a few hours free. Or maybe I want to brew after work. And I can go straight, you know, by the home brew store, formulate my recipe when I get there on BrewPal, buy my ingredients, and I'm done. Like, I don't have to go home to my computer and figure something out. I don't know. I think BrewPal, it's very user-friendly. It's very flexible. It's edited. You know, you can add your own ingredients in. It's a great little tool, especially for $1.99.
Yep. Yep. I use that a little bit. I'm relatively new to using brewing software at all. I mean, even in Homestead, I think I got BrewPal a year ago when I started brewing with you at your house. And I was like, oh, you know, that's actually pretty nifty to have. And it has helped that. But I didn't use it for recipe formulation. I really only used it for like to find out attenuation or trying to see where I should be and where I would end up,
right?
Kind of stuff. Now it's a different ball game. Shit just got real up there, and I got to be brewing at 508. And I actually ended up getting because my predecessor had been using Beersmith. I've moved on to Beersmith, and I really like that program.
Yeah, and that's very popular as well. They have a great. I mean, the website's fantastic, and the interface is. I've watched you use it.
Yeah. I mean, same thing. You dial in everything, and it gives you the color, and also it gives you the BJCP guidelines. You know, so it dials you in on where you are, kind of within the range, if you want to brew to style, or if you want, you know, as close as you want to be.
Yep.
And it has helped a lot, but you have to know the efficiency of your brew house. That's where things kind of change, and that's where I'm definitely learning a lot here at 508 because, you know, I'm getting ridiculous efficiency. Like I'm getting roughly 90% to 95% efficiency, and I think that maybe I need to, you know, readjust my mill because my grist is pretty, you know, pretty fine. But I'm not noticing any astringency.
Right.
So it's true. I mean, everything's been okay, but everything I aim at has been just imperial, my imperial table beers. You know, it's been pretty fun, but I'm learning. So you type that into these things and
yeah.
to get the
accurate thing. Well, the other thing is, though, I think a lot of times what I'll do if I want to look for recipes, I mean, we've talked about this book before, but Brewing Classic Styles by
Jamil Zanishev.
Love him. Is a fantastic book. And usually if I want to base my beer on a style, I go there. I look, you know, kind of roughly what they use and then go from there. I mean, the other thing is BrewPal, and I think a lot of homebrewing software does this, is it will compare, it'll kind of tell you how close you are to the BJCP style.
Right.
As far as like IBUs, original gravity, that kind of thing, color. And that's helpful as well. But definitely looking at recipes. Otherwise, I scour the internet. I'm a consummate internet researcher. So, and there's a lot of, I mean, you have to filter through a lot of it, but there's a lot of very helpful information on the internet.
I always say to my saxophone students, you know, it's the idea is to learn everything and forget it as soon as possible. And, you know, you don't have to root a style at all. Like, these things are kind of fun, but you it's also good. Don't want to go into... but it's good reference, and once you brew for a while, you know what's going on and what flavors impart or what grains impart different flavors, and you get a better idea. I had a fun time going to I brewed a collaboration beer with Brian Strumke of Stillwater recently down at 508 called called Amber. It's a smoked amber ale, and we just didn't really know exactly what we wanted. We knew we wanted a good amount of smoked malt, and we wanted it to be an amber ale, and then we just went to the homebrew store, and it's kind of like we did the thing that I usually kind of shun upon. Like, I don't want to just like pick this and that and that and then end up with this brown beer, but we were very judicious and got different things, and basically really were just got great complexity in it, and it was really, really nice, and it was inspiring to do that instead of like plan it all out ahead of time, and it was fun. Different than what I often say compared to I was inspired last year by Drew Beecham's talk about the power of one and not using too many ingredients, and you know, when a common mistake is going to the homebrew store and just like, I'll use that, and then it all ends up being this brown beer, and sometimes less is more.
Yep. So with that, actually, so another thing besides all these so I actually got this grow mat, which is designed for seedlings, and it comes with a regulator, or I bought a regulator that goes with it as well. And that's, our apartment right now, frankly, is too cold. We live in this very drafty loft in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and it's
like
too cold to ferment some of the lacto stuff that I want to ferment. So I can't remember where I came across this, but anyway, I bought this seed heating mat. It was not very expensive, and so I'm going to be setting that up this week and doing a lot of other, you know, my alternative fermentations that I love and hold dear to my heart. But the other thing that I'm interested in doing is table beers. So we were at Over Craft Beer Week. We were at Josh Bernstein's Homebrew Jamboree at Jimmy's, and Kyler Surface had this delightful Scotch Ale.
You mean Jimmy from Beer Sessions Radio on HeritageRadioNetwork.org on Tuesdays at 5? That Jimmy?
Absolutely. Jimmy's a huge supporter of our homebrew community. But anyway, Kyler had this Scotch Ale that was 2.8%. So his wife is breastfeeding, and he had made her, he wanted to make her a beer that was, you know, delightful, but yet low alcohol enough that
wasn't going to get the baby smashed.
Exactly. And it was really a nice beer, very drinkable. So I want to do a table beer contest. So we're going to ask you guys, it could be anything, but it has to be under 3% alcohol by volume. And we're going to have more details on this on our website, and we'll talk about it next week a little bit, but basically...
Is Kvass legal on this?
I think it has to be a beer.
But Kvass is a
peasant
beer.
As long as it has some kind of grain in it. It has to have barley, wheat, some kind of grain in it.
So not a Kvass from bread, or half from bread, or some grain, or
yeah,
what?
Some grain. It has to have some grain.
Okay.
So anyway, we'll iron this out this week, but we're gonna have a party for everybody who enters a beer. We'll have a party at our loft. We'll all taste these beers. It's not going to be an official judging, and then eventually we'll have a show on table beers, and we will invite the top three people to come on and join us.
And you're,
here on
if
the
you're
radio.
Out of state, we'll pay your gas for the party. I don't mean that. Heritage Radio Network. Well, that's Jack's like, yeah, we can do that.
Anyway, so start thinking about table beers. I think those are really nice to have, and I'm a little obsessed with like getting any flavor from that low of alcohol. So start thinking about that. We also want your feedback, so we're going to ask for that as well. We're going to ask for your comments on our Facebook page, on our website, or please email us at fermentaboutit@gmail.com. We're going to take everybody who comments and gives us feedback. What do you want to hear? What do you want us to talk about? Who do you want on as guests? We're going to take all the comments.
We haven't forgotten the rice wine thing. We're working on it. We'll get
that's true. And we're going to choose a winner, and we're the winner. We'll raffle a winner from everybody who comments, and they were going to get a guided tasting at 508 with Chris and myself.
Hey.
So we'll have some beer and some food and some fun. So anyway, please let us hear from you. We'll put that information on our website probably tomorrow.
And thanks for listening to Ferment About It on Heritage Radio.
We're doing wine next week, so tune in.
Why not?
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.